Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I am the Assistant Director with the Regulatory Transparency Project. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today, we will be discussing the work of the new Department of Government Efficiency, more commonly known as DOGE, and how it relates to regulatory reform efforts at the state level. Our moderator today is Jonathan Wolfson, the Chief Legal Officer and Policy Director at the Cicero Institute. Thank you all so much for joining us today. I'll start by handing things over to you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Libby, and thanks to the Regulatory Transparency Project and the Federalist Society for hosting today's podcast. It's a privilege for me to be here. Our guests today and our experts on today's panel are Reeve Bolt, who is the Director of the Virginia Office of Regulatory Management, and Patrick Price, who's General Counsel to Indiana Governor Mike Braun. And we're going to spend some time today talking a little bit about what regulatory reform has looked like at the state level and what sort of lessons both Reeve and Patrick and their teams have learned that can be applicable as DOGE and the Trump administration and other states around the country consider how to address regulatory reform. So Reeve and Patrick, thanks for both being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, gentlemen, every day there's talk about how federal regulations make it harder for Americans to build businesses, afford to live, keep their jobs, for businesses to try to navigate all of this red tape. But a lot of these discussions seem to ignore state regulatory burdens. And in your roles, you have a chance to tell the state story every single day. Can you talk to us a little bit, Reeve first and then Patrick, about how state regulations stifle your individual states and what motivates you to work every day to improve the regulatory climate?
Yeah, fantastic question, Jonathan. You know, I think that's exactly right, that if you look at, the popular conversation, the focus is almost exclusively on what's happening at the federal level. And there's often, obviously there are very, very important things happening there. The Trump administration, I think, has taken a very aggressive approach to reform, which, is good to see. But there's also, like you say, a lot of really important and interesting work happening at the state level as well. And to be honest with you, it's something that I wasn't horribly familiar with. Prior to taking on this job, I had worked almost exclusively at the federal level, either in private practice or in the federal government. So it's really been somewhat of an eye opener to see just how important state regulation is and how significant an impact it has on people's day-to-day lives. In some ways, maybe even more so, at least in certain areas than at the federal level, because I think a lot of the federal regulations, though they're very, very significant in terms of the economic impact that they have, they often apply to corporations or to, relatively large entities, sometimes to the states themselves. Of course, some federal regulations apply directly to people. But what I've seen at the state level is that, since it's somewhat closer to, to the people themselves, oftentimes the regulations are even more impactful in terms of how they affect people's day-to-day lives. So, for instance, almost all professional licensing happens at the state level. And it's a really, really important topic because, in the last few decades, more and more professions have become subject to professional licensing. And it's really sort of a gateway to the middle class. If you can get a job as a nurse or, a plumber or an electrician, it's a relatively high paying job, but the state sort of gatekeeps in terms of who can get into those professions. So how the regulations are designed and how they're applied is really, really important in terms of people's ability to get ahead. You talk about sort of the motivation for, for doing this work, to me, that makes it really easy to come to work every day because, you know, you can see how your actions are affecting people's day-to-day lives. You know, we've been able to streamline a lot of those burdens, make it easier for people to get into the professions. I think that that's really, really important in terms of rebuilding the middle class. And then I think it's also very, very important in a time of very high inflation that you have a larger workforce, that you allow people to get into these critical professions like nursing, where, you know, we oftentimes have a shortage. At least from my perspective, that's really sort of been the eye opener, is sort of how much impact state regulation has on people's daily lives and how changes to those regulations can really have, you know, significant implications in terms of the economy, inflation, and, you know, allowing hardworking people to get ahead.
Well, Reeve, it's hard to really add a lot to what you said. I think, you know, want to call out a couple of things Reeve said that I very much agree with. I mean, there is so much more attention on what the federal government does because there's so much more money attached to it. And so you've got the ads, you've got the big interest, you have the corporations, you have the lawyers and the marketing people, the whole news cycle, whereas what the state does really gets into more of the nitty-gritty of individual lives. And so, you know, it was neat, just kind of highlighting a few of the things Reeve said, like professional licenses, what it takes to be a massage therapist or a respiratory therapist or a radiation tech, the people that live in your neighborhood, what it takes for them to practice, how many hours of continuing education do they have to do? What do they have to file? And I think the estimate now is like something like what, 1 in 3 professions now require some sort of government licensure. It's also land use, like what can you do on your property? What child care availability, that's a big issue we have in Indiana, that those are regulated at the state level. And so how do we provide for a safe environment for children, but also create the incentives to have adequate childcare. If you throttle back childcare too much, then there's not capacity. People don't have somewhere to watch their children while they work. So now you have a workforce issue. And that becomes a state economic development issue. Because potentially we put too many restrictions on the creation of new child cares or the number of children that can be in a child care. But you relax those too much and you have an unsafe environment, and then, you know, children are harmed, and that's a problem too. So there's a lot of those really close to home issues that we deal with on a really a daily basis. The things that impact somebody's life, that you work with, that you go to church with, that you see on the street. Those are the issues that we deal with. And it's interesting because there's not that money behind it. You don't have the corporations, you don't have the consultants, you don't have the news cycle. And so we are really making decisions that impact our neighbors' lives out of the limelight and out of attention. And I think that's one of the things that motivates me, because a lot of the things that we look at, we're about the only people putting scrutiny on them other than the agency itself. And so that's a weighty responsibility. The feds, anything they do, you're going to have 1,000 eyes on it. But at the state level, some of these regulations that I just discussed or Reeve just discussed that an agency is going to put out, you may have 5 people look at it, and 2 of them are in this call here. So, you know, that's that's a weighty responsibility. And then we think about the decisions that we make, the regulations that we put in place impact our neighbors and our communities. That's a lot. And that's a reason to get up every day. That's a reason to do your job. And that's a reason to feel proud about what we do.
No, that's great, Patrick. And I really do think that the emphasis on how regulations affect the smallest entities, the small neighborhood bookstore or neighborhood daycare, those sort of entities that might not be able to hire lawyers or lobbyists to go, and even in their state capitals, to represent them. But those folks, they, you know, they're trying to figure out how to navigate it. And obviously, both of your bosses heard a lot of this when they were on the campaign trail. And so as a result, both Governor Braun and Governor Youngkin made regulatory reform a significant priority in their administrations. And it wasn't just something they gave lip service to, but they created a strong emphasis by executive orders, by putting senior folks in their administration, as evidenced by the two of you being on this podcast, senior people like y'all who are leading this entire process across their administration. What are some of the key lessons that Indiana and Virginia have learned in your efforts to date? And in your opinion, how might these lessons inform the work of Federal DOJ and OMB? Patrick, we'll start with you.
Great question. So I think one of the big challenges you have with regulation generally is diffuse benefits and concentrated interest. Or concentrated harm. So particularly professional licensing. If you have highly restricted professional licensing requirements, it drives up consumer prices generally. It makes things costly. It harms society writ large, but each individual person at a very small level. Whereas that industry itself has a very high stake in maintaining their limitations. And so one of the challenges, everybody's like, yes, I hate regulation. It's overbearing, but mine are fine. So that's one of the challenges. It's kind of like your congressman. You hate Congress, but your congressperson's fine. And so that's one of the challenges, that anytime you're trying to cut regulation, there's usually somebody that's invested in that regulation. So you have to, you know, be willing to push back on interest and be willing to vocalize why you're doing it. And particularly with a number of these things, particularly the state deals with, where you don't have money parties, and you're talking about they don't have the lobbyists, they don't have somebody that's reviewing this, you're speaking up for the people that don't have somebody. So I do think that when you do it larger, and we copied Virginia, where you have like a 25% reduction cut, you're not targeting any one industry. You're not like, I'm not going to take on this powerful association or that, you know, powerful lobbying group. I'm taking on regulation writ large. And so then you're working with the agencies to say, okay, you need to come up with a plan to reduce your regulation by this much. And again, you're not targeting any one, you're targeting regulation as a whole. And so then it's like, okay, we need to figure out the best way to reduce it. And then you can get more people in the room and be like, we have to reduce it by this much. Let's figure out where are the best ways to do it. Because there's always going to be somebody pushing to keep their regulation. So that's always a challenge.
Reed.
I think Patrick is absolutely right. You know, that's something that I've observed as well. I had sort of read it in the public choice literature that you have sort of these incentive problems, but to actually see it in action has really been very, very striking. You know, I think Patrick puts it perfectly when he says the perspective is, you know, yeah, the cumulative burden of regulation is a problem, but our regulations are actually really useful. You know, we want to keep those. And that's where having this, you know, 25% or 33% or whatever the target is across the board goal, I think is much more effective. It reminds me of, I think this was a decade or more ago, but there was at a federal level some interest in closing down certain military bases. And if you chose a particular base, then of course everybody in the community and the senators and the congresspersons from the states would oppose it vehemently. So they had to give a package, you know, of multiple different bases of an up or down vote. You know, that was more effective. So I think that's definitely one of the principles, you know, that in Indiana and Virginia and the Idaho, you know, the other states that have, you know, done, you know, significant work in this space, that they've that they've taken. Another thing that I think is also sort of related to that point is that, you know, if you look at it, and you know, I sort of see this every day because we actually review the regulations. And even if you don't have a vested interest, you know, like any one regulation in isolation usually makes some sense. You know, it may be overburdensome in some respects, but overall, you know, it's sort of thrust in the right direction. So you can see how over time this accretion happens, just more and more builds up. This one makes sense and that one makes sense. But you ultimately end up with something that's just this overpowering, you know, crushing burden, cumulative weight of all of these regulations. And Jonathan, you sort of made the point that, you know, small businesses, I think in particular, find this impossible to navigate. The corpus of regulations is so complicated that it's much, much easier just not even to go into business, because it's, you know, far easier to go to work for a large company where they have an in-house legal department that can figure that all out for them. And so I think it has a really negative effect in terms of hurting the dynamism of the overall market, you know, making it very difficult for new players to enter the space. And that's where I think something like a 25% reduction makes a lot of sense. You're cutting back on that overarching burden. And then you're leaving it up to the agencies and the stakeholders to sort of figure out which 25% to cut. And, you know, we've seen it's actually worked out pretty well. You know, they've sort of done a pretty good job, in my opinion, you know, of finding where those cuts can be. But I think you need an overarching target like that. And in terms of lessons for DOGE, you know, and the federal government, you know, I love the 10 for one that President Trump put out. I think that's a great idea. I think it would also be really worthwhile to look at something like a percentage reduction target, or maybe a dollar reduction target. You know, we're going to cut regulatory burdens by, you know, X number, you know, billions of dollars. I think that would also set a good incentive to, we're not just going to slow down the growth of regulation, we're actually going to cut back on this massive corpus of regulations we built up over decades and decades.
And if I could add something to what Reeve said, it's not just the total weight of regulation that could become crushing, it's those incremental changes as well. Because if you think about, you're a small business, you went into business to do whatever that business is, whether, you know, you're a restaurant, you're childcare, you're building widgets, like that is your job. You didn't go into business to keep track of what are the latest regulations from the government. And so if there is even a small worthwhile regulatory change every year, that in and of itself is a burden, because you have to be monitoring all the time. You have to be changing your operations all the time. And so having certainty, or having, like, you know, this is the ceiling and it's only going to get less restrictive, something like that really helps with certainty and understanding, so that those people who want to be doing their business can focus on their business, not on whatever the regulators are doing.
Yeah, and you know, the challenge for those small businesses is that it doesn't stop with just the regulations. When I was in the first Trump administration at the Labor Department, we were trying to implement the president's executive order to review and eliminate unnecessary guidance documents. And one of the crazy things we found at the Department of Labor was there were guidance documents that were decades old that existed in only one place, and that was in the law library at the U.S. Department of Labor. And that meant that if you were that small business in Indiana, you could theoretically be in violation of a guidance document that the only way you would know about it would be as if you'd hired a high-priced Washington, D.C. lawyer to go and comb through the sheets of paper inside that library to find out whether or not your actions at your business, at your restaurant or what have you, was in compliance with that law. And, you know, guidance documents are one of those ways that in some worlds, you know, it can be, the concept makes a lot of sense, right? You write a complicated regulation and then the restaurant says, hey, what do you mean by having, you know, clean cooking oil? And, you know, they write this regulation that talks about it. They're like, well, if I change it out every 3 days, is that good? And the agency thinks they're being helpful. They're like, yeah, change it every 3 days. Well, now suddenly the law has become change it out every 3 days, not that that's what the regulation actually is. And if somebody figures out a way to have change it out every 5 days be just as clean and healthy for the customers, then they feel like they're in violation of the law. You two wrote a great blog post, and you were talking about guidance documents, and you urged federal reformers to not overlook these guidance documents and kind of take a playbook out of the last Trump administration and say, hey, the president made an emphasis on this. Guidance documents continue to be issued in the prior administration. And as they're trying to reduce these regulatory burdens, don't ignore the burdens that guidance documents have. Talk a little bit about why guidance documents and the burdens they impose are an important consideration. And then, given the vast number of guidance documents, is it just impossible to deal with the costs and burdens of guidance documents, given how many, you know, million guidance documents there happen to be in the world? We'll start with you, Reeve.
So I think it's a fantastic, you know, question, Jonathan. And I think, and Patrick, in my piece, we refer to it as regulatory dark matter. And I think that's a good analogy. Or the other analogy I'm often reminded of, and I'm not a classicist, so I'm not 100% sure this is true, but I once read that the Emperor Caligula, you know, in Rome, if you passed a law, it had to be made publicly available. So he would write the laws on the very top of the column so that nobody could see them. That way, you know, you were still making it available, but, you know, complying with the letter of the law, but nobody knew what the law actually was. I don't think it's quite as sinister as that, but I think we're sort of in a similar situation now where, you know, yeah, nobody really knows how many guidance documents there are. In my previous job at the Administrative Conference of the United States, we did a project on guidance documents. And the conclusion we reached is nobody knows how many of these things there are. It could be millions, because it could be something as simple as, yeah, like you said, you know, some thing in the law library or, you know, some report on somebody's computer. And it's a really significant problem, you know, for the reasons that we've been discussing. Small businesses in particular, even if they could somehow digest the entirety of the CFR, you know, which I think is a fiction, you know, even then, they wouldn't be anywhere close to, you know, knowing the answer, because there's a whole separate, you know, corpus of guidance documents out there. So, I think it's been a blind spot historically. And I, you know, really loved what the first Trump administration did in terms of, you know, ensuring that those guidance documents were at least put online. It baffles me that the Biden administration rescinded that and, you know, actually basically, you know, encouraged the agencies to take them back down. But, you know, I think the Trump administration has reinstated that order. I think that that's great. I think that, you know, what we're both doing in both of our states, I think is also, you know, really pointed in the right direction. So in Virginia, we actually require agencies not only to cut requirements and regulations, but also to ensure, one, that there are not requirements in guidance documents, that if it's a requirement, it has to be moved to the regulation or otherwise just not enforced. And then two, we look at the aggregate length of the guidance documents, the total number of words in the guidance documents. And what we found is there's just an enormous amount of things out there that are very complicated, very out of date, and just can be massively streamlined. We recently had one of our agencies that cut, I think, was something like 500,000 words. From a guidance document, which, you know, I put out a little write-up on it. I think that's roughly the length of War and Peace in terms of the total number of words that they were cutting from these guidance documents. So I think, you know, as the Trump administration, DOGE and OIRA move forward, I think it's really, really important to ensure that guidance does not get overlooked, that they're ensuring that the guidance is streamlined, and that the guidance that they still do want people to comply with is made easily available in a, you know, publicly accessible place on a website, and that it's very, very clear what the agency intends with that guidance document, because that's the only way that businesses or citizens can effectively navigate the process.
Yeah, so I really love everything Reeve said. I'll take this in a little slightly different direction and talk about kind of why we have, at least why I think we have guidance documents and what we've done to try to address that. And, you know, a big part of talking about incentives, I'm big on incentives, but, you know, in theory, all the laws should be passed by the legislature. You know, I think that's perhaps what our founders envisioned and assumed, but it's hard to pass laws. And you know, perhaps they're technical or whatever. So the legislature has delegated some authority to agencies to do regulations, which carry the effect of law, because lawmaking is hard. So, you know, agencies can do regulations, but particularly the federal level and at some of our states, doing regulations is hard. And so agencies still want to do things, and so you start doing guidance documents. And you're kind of passing that lawmaking down because, you know, we hear this all the time. Our agencies are like, well, we need to be nimble. We need to be able to react. There's changing circumstances, and, you know, it takes too long to change the law, or it takes too long to change the regulation, and so we have to be able to adapt, and so we have guidance documents. And so the need for them is you're responding to a real need, or Reeve talked about, like, how often do you have to change your oil? There is a real need for that. The challenge is, and what we've seen like in Indiana, is that because it was hard to do regulations, that agencies just started doing things through guidance documents and just start creating requirements in guidance documents. And it's really hard to police all of those things. And so what we did in Indiana and driven by the legislature was try to empower people who have the biggest incentive. So that would be the people that these enforcement actions are being taken against. And so our law was changed to get rid of deference to the agencies in administrative proceedings. There's no deference to their legal interpretation. The agency has to prove its case by a preponderance of the evidence. And if they rely on guidance documents as the basis for their decision, the primary basis, there's mandatory attorney's fees to the other party. So the agency has to be able to point to a statute or a regulation that justifies the requirement. And we've taken that you can't just say, do whatever I want. Your regulation has to spell out what it is that you want. And so doing that, you've now given tools to the people who have these regulatory burdens put on them to fight back. And so rather than like Reeve or I trying to go around and play whack-a-mole with the agencies, you're empowering the people out there, empowering attorneys to police the agencies and give them a mechanism. Because again, like at the state level, a lot of the things we deal with don't have those big money behind them. And so, you know, if it's the license for your profession or your business, do you have $10,000 to pay an attorney to fight a $250 citation? No, like that's not a good business decision. But, you know, if the attorney knows that they can get their fees paid, if they find challenges, well, now you've essentially deputized private attorneys to help you monitor what agencies are doing. And we've done training with our administrative law judges on these standards. And so we'll see like administrative law judge opinions that come out, and it'll be like agency A required this person to do X. X is only contained in this guidance document. It's not in statute. It's not in regulation. Agency, you lose. And so it's kind of building that culture. You train the ALJs, you train the private attorneys, and you help them police you.
No, that's a great point. And Patrick, as you're talking about incentives and the importance of getting all of those levers right, you know, Reeve, how should states and Patrick, maybe you want to comment more after Reeve, but, you know, how should states and the federal officials try to set up the right systems that create the incentives to get those good outcomes, right? You want to have systems that motivate the legislature to write clear laws that motivate the regulators to regulate only where they need to and regulate only with the least burdensome path. And you want the courts to step in when the regulators fail to do that. You want to incentivize the public to challenge the regulators when they're getting coloring outside the lines. What are the systems that you have found both in Virginia and Indiana that do that? And Patrick, you've already mentioned some, but Reeve, if you want to maybe talk about some of the ones in Virginia, and there's probably others, Patrick, that you can think of or things that the governor is considering doing as he continues his term that really do put those levers in the right place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think Patrick is absolutely right to sort of, you know, to sort of put the emphasis on incentives. You know, I think we're both, you know, in our state sort of coming at it from an economic perspective. And, you know, in economics, incentives are everything. That's how you ensure that, you know, people engage in the behavior that you consider more socially beneficial. And I think, you know, Jonathan, it has to, you know, I think ultimately at the federal level sort of be a multi-pronged approach. You know, I think from a judicial perspective, you know, revisiting the non-delegation doctrine, you know, I think would really make a big difference in terms of setting the right incentives for the legislature. But from an executive perspective and in terms of what we've been able to do here in Virginia, I think, you know, one thing that we've done that I think has worked remarkably well, even better than I sort of thought it would at the outset, is just setting a very clear goal and then working with the agencies in order to achieve that goal. And that's why I think something like a 25% reduction that both Virginia and Indiana have done. And then backing that up, having, you know, somebody like Patrick or myself, having somebody in the executive, you know, branch in the governor's office to actually participate and, you know, oversee that process, I think is really, really critical. And I think, you know, when past efforts have not succeeded, I think it's because one of those two things are missing. If you don't set a clear goal, and this is why I think it's constantly failed at the federal level up until the first Trump administration, is I think going back to Jimmy Carter, you had so-called retrospective review, where basically the agencies were asked to look at their old regulations and decide, do you need this or not? And surprisingly, you know, every single time they said, yeah, we do need this. You know, we need to carry it forward. So it was, you know, it was an abject failure. It never went anywhere. You know, Trump was the first one to actually change that, you know, by putting in place the 2-for-1 executive order. Now you had a clear goal. Now you had something like a budget, basically, where if you want to enact a new regulation, that's fine, but you're going to have to find existing savings in order to offset that. And then I think something like a 25% reduction also works exceedingly well because, you know, there's a very clear goal that everybody is working towards. And what I found is actually the agency officials really buy into it. And that's what sort of surprised me. You know, I expected that, you know, having worked at the federal level, that you'd get more pushback. But from the agency officials' perspective, I think their concerns with previous reform efforts were that it wasn't clearly defined, you know, what that 25% was, what a regulatory requirement is, how you actually hit that. They just had a lot of questions. And that's why I think the second critical element is having a centralized entity that can supervise that process is critical, because we've been able to answer those questions. We've been able to work with the agencies to help them get to the 25% and find innovative ways to get to the 25%. And the end result is, you know, we will hit the 25%, you know, in the next few weeks. I think we'll get across the finish line. I think even more excitingly, we've saved $1.2 billion per year in terms of the changes that we've made. So it produces significant results. But I think it requires, from an incentive perspective, that you have a clear goal and you have somebody to work with the agencies towards achieving that goal. And that's my hope, is that as DOGE, you know, as OMB, you know, really start digging into the federal regulations, that they will ensure that those two elements are there, because I think that's the difference between success and failure.
Yeah, so I, again, I love everything Reeve said. I also was laughing at your question, Jonathan, because it was almost like saying, suppose we live in a civil libertarian utopia where citizens take their responsibilities seriously, legislators take their responsibilities seriously, and bureaucrats do as well. And I'm like, I would love to live there, Jonathan. How do I get there? I think that I'll start with the federal level because that's where Reeve started. I think that, as he said, it's going to take a multi-pronged approach because there are so many things that need to be changed. Part of it is Congress has to be able to pass laws, and they have to be able to pass laws that are detailed and specific, rather than passing all of the burden on to the agencies to actually set the standards. Also, like tying in the guidance documents, I think the courts have a lot of responsibility there because doctrines like our deference and some of those other deference doctrines that the court created a standard where the agencies had absolute deference in interpreting their own regulations. And so if I were an agency attorney, my recommendation to my agency head and the federal system would be we should have very vague regulations and then do everything through guidance document because we will get absolute deference there. If we actually specify it in regulation, it can be attacked and there are challenges. But if we give ourselves maximum deference or maximum flexibility and then do it all through guidance, we're going to get absolute deference from the courts. Well, then that creates a perverse incentive. So I think getting rid of the non-delegation doctrine, as Reeve mentioned, rolling back those deferences, particularly our and the rolling back Chevron, rolling back those various deferences is going to put more burden on the agencies to be specific in their regulations, not rely on guidance. At the state level, it's interesting. And as Reeve said, the target is really important. I think one of the things when you have a target too is you can incentivize agency heads because like Mike Pence tried to do this when he was governor. He directed all agencies to go back and review their regulations and find things that are outdated and all that. And as Reeve said, like almost everybody's like, no, all our stuff is great. We had like two agencies actually take it seriously and cut their regulations. The rest didn't. Now, if you celebrate those agencies, that helps. But like when you have that target and it's like 25%, that's a floor, not a ceiling. So then when your agency heads like hit their 25%, it's like, hey, you know, agriculture has cut their regulations by 25%, commerce or revenue, why are you behind? So you kind of create that. I think something else that he mentioned that's really important is having somebody at the governor's office level driving this. And one of the things that we're trying to stress in the Braun administration is that all of the lawyers that work in the agencies, their client is the governor. And that's a mental shift because as I was talking about earlier, if I was like working in the federal system, my guidance to the agency head would be, you know, do it all through guidance, not regulation, because that gives us the most flexibility. But if you're stressing to all of your agency attorneys, your client is not your agency. Your client is the elected head. And this is what the elected head's goal is. Work on that. Don't just look at this from what is best for my agency, what is easiest for me, but look at your job is how do I carry out my elected chief's policy goal? And his policy goal is this. And so that's a message we're trying to push down hard and say, hey, we're all on the same team. We're all speaking with the same voice. And this is what your mission is. And so we can say at this level, like, don't cut the corners. Don't take the easy out. And then push that to them, and then that helps them push back on their agency too. Say, no, you know, there is this easy out, but I'm being told from the top, we have to do it the right way.
Yeah, and Patrick, along those veins, I think The importance of leadership, and that starts obviously at the very top with the chief executive, whether that's the governor in both of y'all's cases or the president, and telling cabinet secretaries that that's part of how they're going to evaluate them, that cabinet secretaries continue to pass that message on to directors or assistant secretaries or whatever the title is for sub-agencies. Can you talk a little bit, Patrick, about how both your boss, the governor, is implementing that across his administration and the importance that you see in that message not just being kind of, hey, I'm going to sign an executive order and move on, and when you have a cabinet meeting, you never talk about it, versus making it something that is a constant reminder from your boss to all of his direct reports?
That's a great question for what we're doing. So I will say, as a preface, Indiana does not have civil service protections the way like the federal government does, or some other states. And Reeve, I don't know if Virginia does.
We do. We do.
So almost all of our employees in the state are at will. So that helps. I mean, there's pluses and minuses. You don't get the professionalism that you might have with the civil service, but you have a little bit more control. And so, Jonathan, to your question, what Governor Braun has done, which has been a departure from practice of prior governors, where a number of these efforts were done, but not necessarily publicly trumpeted. What he has been doing is doing executive orders. We've done, I think, 64, 65 so far, which is well ahead of his predecessors. I think he's done more than Mike Pence did in his entire 4 years. So he lays out a policy objective, say, reduced by 25%. That is then communicated to the cabinet secretaries. These are your objectives. They've got timelines, but then each of those executive orders has various check-in points. So on the 25%, anytime they're readopting a rule, they have to go through a rigorous analysis. And there's certain defaults, like if your regulation hasn't changed in 8 years, there's a default assumption that it should be put into statute. So now you have to give us your plan for how you're going to work this into statute. Every year under this, you have to do an annual regulatory projection report. Here's what we're going to be doing over the next year. Here's the steps, the concrete steps we're taking to get to that 25% over 4 years. And that's been true with virtually all of Governor Braun's executive orders. There's some sort of check-in step. There's a public accountability step. So he's saying, this is what I'm doing, and here is where there's going to be a check-in point where I'm going to hold myself publicly accountable for what we've done. And then we're going to have to release that. And so like on the 25% goal, we gave agencies 4 years. But we're not going to say, hey, we're going to wait 3 years and 9 months and then check in and you're going to panic. We're going to be checking in with you at regular intervals, making sure you have a plan. You're going to be presenting that. We're going to be policing it. So it is active engagement. It is active monitoring with public facing accountability steps at critical junctures so that, you know, the outside world can say, yes, you did what you said you were going to do.
I would just sort of echo everything, you know, Patrick said. I think that's precisely right. And I think that is what distinguishes, you know, Indiana, Virginia, Idaho, I think is another great example of how this has, you know, really been successful from cases where it hasn't been. I think you have to have, first of all, the governor, you know, buying in 100%. And in Governor Youngkin's case, you know, he came in with the goal of making Virginia the best place to live, work, and raise a family. And regulatory reform is a big, big piece of that. So, you know, the governor, the chief of staff, throughout the last 3.5 years, they've really, really constantly emphasized that this is a critical part of the mission we're trying to achieve. And having somebody like Patrick or myself or Alex Adams in Idaho, you know, the people who have worked on this, who's sort of a centralized entity that can supervise the process, work with the agencies, work with the other secretaries, you know, keep the emphasis on the issue because it's a long-term process. It's taken, you know, us 3.5 years. And Patrick, you said similarly, you know, you set a goal of 4 years, you know, it requires consistent attention. And then getting the buy-in, yeah, from the agencies and the people at the agencies. I think it all has to be there in order for it to work. Otherwise, I think you get into these incentive problems that we've been discussing, that if you set a goal, but there's no backing behind that goal, there's nobody following up, it's really, really easy just to push it to the side and either ignore it or, you know, come up with some small tweak that's really pretty meaningless and declare victory. Like I won't give this specific example, mostly just because I can't remember it, but I did sort of remember as we were sort of considering our reforms, we talked to a few other states, and one of the states said basically what happened is they took the requirements out of the regulations and they put them in a guidance document instead. And then they said, okay, we got rid of 25%. It's like, well, no, that's even worse. You know, that now basically, you know, it's not even clear whether it's enforceable. So if you give people the opportunity to sort of, you know, cut corners, then they'll do it. But if you ensure that that oversight, you know, continues to exist throughout the process, that's where you get to the meeting reforms like what we've seen in Indiana and Virginia and Idaho and the states where this has succeeded.
And I think, as Reeve said, that buy-in from the top is where it starts.
You know, one of the things that agencies, you know, you talk about this process and everybody trying to, you know, everybody has their fiefdoms. One of the things that is disrupting government and every other part of the world is AI. And talk a little bit about, is AI a useful tool in accelerating these regulatory reform efforts? How have your states used it or thinking about using it? And how might federal OMB or DOGE use AI to supercharge their regulatory reforms? Reeve, we'll start with you.
Yeah, fantastic question. And I think this is really the next big thing. I think this is what's really going to, you know, take the type of work that each of our states has done, what the federal government is doing, and just supercharge it, you know, take it to the next level. So here in Virginia, we actually just very recently, you know, kicked off a pilot project. And for us, this is going to be sort of the last kind of major initiative that we undertake. We've got about 7 to 8 months left in office. So we will hit our 25%, but we don't want to stop there. You know, that's not the governor's style. He's fond of saying, you know, we're hitting the accelerator. So we're really going to continue to accelerate all the way to the end. And we think using AI to actually go in and basically scan the entire regulatory corpus, compare it to the statute, and determine, you know, what's actually mandatory and what's discretionary. What are you, you know, building upon the statute? And then the other key piece of it is then comparing Virginia regulations to those in other states. So if Indiana, you know, can, you know, their barbers require half as many training hours as ours do, then we should change ours. You know, there's, you know, if it works in another state, there's no issue, then that presents a great opportunity to revisit your own regulations and look at streamlining those. And the problem is, in the past, you could do that. Alex Adams in Idaho told me he did that. You know, they looked at South Dakota and North Dakota and the states around Idaho. But it takes a really long time if a human being is doing that, whereas AI can go in there and do it, not necessarily instantaneously, but like within a matter of a few minutes, basically, spit out a result. And then you can use that to help, you know, streamline the regulation. So I think it's going to really be a game changer. I think that states that are reluctant to do something like this because it's, you know, it's time consuming, I think if they can use AI, it's going to save them just an enormous amount of time and resources. So I think it's going to make these sorts of reforms more feasible nationwide. And I think at the federal level, you know, DOGE has already made significant use of AI, as I understand it, in the, you know, personnel space and in the contracting space. So I think it's a very natural fit to apply that same sort of logic to the regulations. And I think it will supercharge their efforts as well and allow them to accomplish a lot more in a short period of time than otherwise would have been possible.
Patrick.
So shockingly, I'm going to agree with everything Reeve said. I think AI is uniquely advantageous in this space because one of the big challenges with operating in this space is mapping everything. And as Reeve was saying, that is a labor-intensive job. So you have statutes, you have regulations, you have guidance documents, you have forms, you have all of these things, and that is a challenge. And so, you know, like when I was reviewing regulations and we would get them in, and Reeve talked about, like, if you have requirements and guidance, they need to be in regulation. That is one of the things that we would do, and it would be very labor intensive. Like you, whatever, you're changing childcare, you're changing pipeline safety, you're changing Medicaid claims forms, whatever it may be, you've got your regulation. We would then go check it against the guidance documents and the forms of the agency to make sure all of the requirements that they were imposing are actually in regulation or statute. That is really time consuming. On the flip side of that too, it's a challenge because every time a statute changes, do you have a good map of all the regulations and forms and guidance that's implicated? And those are things that AI can do much quicker and simpler. And so we've been taking some of the work that I did when I was doing it by hand, and we've created several use cases that we're running through different AI platforms and comparing. We're giving them the same things and saying, okay, you do this and compare to the use cases that I came up with and things that might take me a week. The AI, you know, can get 80% of the way there in 30 minutes. Well, let's do some iterative training and see if we can get that up to like 95%. And then, you know, the next step will be working with the attorneys, because to do AI well, you have to know how to use it and know how to program the terms. And so then we can get the attorneys doing that smarter work. Other things that we're doing, we're trying to map out all of the statutory requirements for each agency. And then you can run that through AI and say, compare what's in statute that this agency is supposed to do with what its website says it's doing. And find me all the areas that the agency is supposed to do that it's not. And on the flip side, give me all the areas that the agency is doing that are not actually in statute. And, you know, as Reeve was saying, you can get up with regulations too. You can compare it with other states as well. One of our executive orders, and this was driven by statute as well, was to do a professional licensing comparison. We have to compare our requirements to several states. Well, that's a great AI tool. You know, take the cosmetology requirements for Indiana and compare them to these eight states and tell us where they match up and where they don't. Like, those are very labor-intensive task for an attorney, but they're very quick for AI. And so the goal is to try to use AI for those menial comparison matching mapping requirements, and then have the attorney time being spent on more of the strategic high level. Where do we want this to go? Is this something we should be doing? To do the qualitative evaluation and have the AI do the grunt work to get there. And at the end, our goal is to have a much better product too. But if our agencies have a flow map of this statute changes or this regulation changes, here's what we need to flow downstream and change, that's just going to make us better. Because that's one of the challenges, I'm sure, Reeve, you've seen, that some of those 10-year-old guidance documents, 40-year-old guidance documents, like, does anybody know if the statutes or regulations have changed in there? Did anybody do a comparison map? Is it even good? Like, nobody knows. And that's where AI can just help tremendously.
Well, Patrick and Reeve, this has been really fascinating and useful information. As we wrap up, one last question. If you could give some advice to DOJ, to other states, thinking about not only regulatory streamlining, but any other initiative that you would recommend that a reform-minded state or federal agency undertake to try to make itself more transparent and promote efficiency in government? As we wrap up, do you have any thoughts on that you'd like to share?
I'm happy to go first if that were so. So I think it's a great question, Jonathan. And I so you mentioned efficiency and transparency, and you know I sort of tend to think of things in economic terms. So you know my focus is usually on efficiency, but what I've really been struck by is just how powerful transparency is as well. And I'll mention another thing we've done in Virginia that, you know, we haven't discussed on this call, but I think is sort of another major accomplishment of our office, at least, or the Governor Youngkin's initiatives that I think, you know, could inform work at the federal level in other states. So the governor, you know, really focused on regulatory burdens when he came into office, but he was also really interested in the permitting process because, you know, it takes a really long time to get a permit. It's a black box. You don't really know where it is in the process. So another major initiative that we've been working on these last 3 years is to create a dashboard, a permitting dashboard that has every single permit application in the state government online. And you can log on to this site. It's permits.virginia.gov. And you can track a permit exactly like you would a FedEx package, basically. It tells you, you know, all the steps in the process, how long it's supposed to take, how long it's actually taking. And what we found is, you know, even when you don't change the permitting at all, even if you leave all of those steps in place, the transparency is a game changer because, you know, we've talked a lot about incentives. It fundamentally shifts the incentives. If nobody knows where the permit is, then there's no accountability. Whereas if you know, oh, it's that person who has it, you know, why has it been sitting on his desk for the last 200 days? You know, then the solution presents itself, you know, very, very quickly. And what we found is just creating this transparency alone, our Department of Environmental Quality has reduced their processing times by 2/3. They've cut by 65% the average time it takes to get a DEQ permit. And the other state agencies, you know, who now are working on the, you know, now have their permits up on the platform. They haven't had them up quite as long. We're working with them to try to achieve significant processing time reductions there as well. So I think just making information available to the public can be extraordinarily valuable because it really starts to set the right incentives. I think you've seen this with DOGE, you know, the fact that they've uncovered just enormous amounts of wasteful spending that people were not even aware of. And I think just making that information available is hugely important. And I think it fundamentally shifts the incentives. So I think efficiency is very, very important, but I think transparency is equally important. And anything you can do to make the process, you know, more open, more clear to the public what's happening, I think it makes a huge difference and really incentivizes major reform.
Patrick, we'll give you the last word.
Well, I agree with Reeve again. You know, it, really transparency is huge. That's one of Governor Braun's biggest themes. I think someone just told me yesterday, they're like, I think I hear Governor Braun say transparency every week. And there's that. I think something else to keep in mind is we have a federal system for a reason. We've got these 50 laboratories of democracy. And so that's what I found really heartening and reassuring was like when I found Dr. Adams, I found Reeve Bull, that there are people across the country doing similar things. You've got Governor Youngkin, you've got Governor Little, you have a lot of enterprising, Governor Braun, shouldn't have left him out. You've got a lot of very enterprising leaders at the state level. And we each have our own unique, you know, twist on our democracy, but there's a lot of common themes. And so, you know, it's great to know, like when I talked with Reeve or Dr. Adams and they're like, okay, we did this and there was some short-term pain, but it was worth it in the long run. And that is really helpful because all of these efforts, there's going to be short-term pain. There's going to be pushback. And, you know, when you've got somebody else that's already blazed that trail and can tell you it's worth it when you get to the end, that helps. And, you know, we're each doing different things. And so the more that we collaborate and share ideas, it helps. And I think it's energizing too, because you start to talk to like-minded people. They're like, oh, we're doing this. Well, that makes me think about something that we can do. And then we come back and, you know, you're kind of raising the bar each time. And that's really fun and really energizing. So I think we just encourage, you know, Doge to keep doing, the states to keep doing, and for like-minded people to collaborate as much as we can.
Well, Patrick and Reeve, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your insight. Thank you for your service and for continuing to sound the horn that this is an important effort, not just at the federal level, but at the state level. And thank you to Libby and the Regulatory Transparency Project and the Federalist Society for hosting today's event.
Awesome.
Thank you, Libby, Jonathan, and Reeve.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks to all of you. This was great.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to, you know, throw that back and say thank you all so much for joining us today. Thanks to Jonathan for moderating this great conversation, and to Reeve and Patrick for sharing your insights from the state regulatory reform perspective. Thank you to our audience for tuning in today. And if you're interested in learning more about all of our programming here, RTP, discussing the regulatory state and the American way of life, please visit our website at regproject.org. That is R-E-G, regproject.org. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.